Today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 93, we'll be asking democracy campaigner and exiled cousin of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad about the future of the country.
Everybody today in Syria is in opposition. Everybody in Syria today wants reforms because everybody is suffering from the situation. People are very eager to get their legitimate rights, their legitimate freedom.
That was Rebel al-Assad, director of the Organization for Freedom and Democracy in Syria. And to broaden the discussion, our man in Cairo is here to share his insights from reporting on the unrest in the Middle East and North Africa.
What's going on in Egypt right now is incredibly important. There is very much a counter-revolution underway. There's a huge battle between people and the army. There's essentially a kind of multipolar power structure whereby different elements are trying to get the ascendancy.
That was Jack Schenker. And later in the program, it's over to Tokyo for an update on the impact the Japan disaster has had on the country's business sectors with our correspondent, Kenji Hall.
There's a Japanese term, jishiku, and it means self-restraint. And you're seeing this manifest itself in all kinds of ways. Companies aren't buying ads on TV. They're not going to karaoke. They're not holding weddings. They're canceling the weddings. They're not going to the department stores and shopping the way they used to.
And now from London, The Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Rob Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, April 3rd, 2011, and you're at the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck, Robert Bound, and Steve Bloomfield, who's sort of become a bit of a fixture at the end of the table, hasn't he, Rob?
I don't know who you're talking about.
Oh, hi, Steve.
He's taken over my old job as well. He's in charge of the aircon.
I know. He's also got the same colour notebook that you have as well.
I know. He copies.
That's true.
He does, doesn't he? Do you have a green notebook as well, Rob?
I've got a black one.
Oh, you did?
Classic.
Oh, yeah. And it's not even a branded one.
No. Look at it.
You're not flying the company colours.
Yeah. Off brand bound.
Off bound. Sorry.
Where's your greenie? Right,
where's your greenie?
No, I just have my own small notepad, but it's got my name on it. Look at that.
It's monikered.
See, this is sort of the new type of email. It's a nice little pad. These are made in Lebanon. And so rather than sending emails, I just write notes. I leave them on people's desks.
What happens if you know the new
air
conditioning
system? If someone walks by fast, it blows away.
Yeah. Windows,
you know,
open.
Guess
as well.
What? If our air conditioning system worked. We had a note from our contracting company this week saying that there was a compressor unit or something that we're missing, which is why we don't have AC at the moment. We don't need it at the moment either, but I'd say probably in about 2 or 3 days we might.
You might do.
And they said they couldn't afford to buy the unit because they're in financial straits of some sort. So
that's bad, isn't
it? They hadn't even ordered the damn piece.
Are you going to give out the name and address?
Absolutely.
Coming up
on our website.
Minutes.
Exactly. Later, yeah. Later in the show.
We're going to tell you how to change a plug.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
Consumer watchdog. Brulé.
It's not good, though, is it?
No, it's not good.
No. Anyway, so we're on to, I don't know, Daikin or Fujitsu or Mitsubishi or one of them, anyway.
Or opening windows.
I think so. We all like a cross breeze.
We do.
Andrew, has it been a good week for you?
Yes, because we've sent the issue to press. That's always a good thing.
And guess what? We're about to get on the plane.
I know. We're off to Madrid.
Olé.
Madrid.
Is that how they should we revisit Andrew's Spanish classes?
No.
Next week's show.
I think Andrew should have his classes on the radio.
Dual track.
Andrew's got 1,000 words of Spanish. Has he not? Because you've got a book.
Got a book called 1,000 words of Spanish.
How many of them do you know now?
I'm doing the conditional at the moment. Very useful the conditional.
You're doing it, you've gone A, B, C, and now you're on conditional. is that what it is?
I would tell you, Robert, but I won't.
That's
okay.
The conditional. It's a great shame. It was a Fabio Capello amount of words.
And on the topic of language, it's a very good segue, actually, that there was an English proficiency index came out this week from the education company EF, who we featured in the magazine some time ago as well. And they've given, I've got a ranking here of 44 countries in terms of English language proficiency. Who do you think scored number 44? Rob?
In terms of English language
proficiency and efficiency, yeah.
What was the clue it begins with?
Is it the English?
It begins with K.
Kenya?
No.
Korea?
No.
Kazakhstan?
Very good. Andrew Tuck,
wow.
1 point.
I think you CC'd on this email.
I don't think he was, actually.
1 point. Okay.
Okay, who scored number one?
England.
Sweden.
Is it close, though? Close.
Holland.
Finland or Norway, surely.
Norway. Half a point
How
for you.
How can Norwegians be better at English than the English?
No, they haven't. They haven't counted. Maybe because Australia, New Zealand, and Canada and the UK all score less than 44. I don't know.
It's non-English speaking nations.
Yeah, non-English as a first language nations. Yeah.
What are the surprises? Norway
did well. Okay, so Norway at number one, then the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Austria, Belgium, Germany, Malaysia, Poland, Switzerland, Hong Kong, South Korea, Japan, Portugal, Argentina. Anyway,
and then Bristol.
Well, what's interesting This is where your language is going to come in handy, Andrew.
Looking the other way now.
When we get to Barajas Airport, yes, Spain's down at number 24. Not good, is it? And also, Italy's incredibly low. One of the key findings of the report is that Spain and Italy lag behind the West of Western Europe.
But it's extraordinary that Poland's so high up as well.
Is it?
Well, I mean, loads of Polish people come here, but still.
I hear the clattering of fingernails right now.
Well, the Poland beat Spain.
Yeah, they did.
I know they did. I'm saying it's interesting that the Eastern Bloc nations have adopted English quicker than the old Spaniards.
Rob, do you have anything to say on that?
No, I've got absolutely nothing to say. I absolutely agree with Andrew on everything. I thought that we were going to have a little bit. We were going to sort of start have a little Daily Mail column moment there.
I was not. I was saying it's interesting. That's good.
Yeah, it's good. Good.
I think we should perhaps head to North London and also to points east as well. Well, like many countries in the Middle East, governing the nation is very much a family affair, but not every family member is always on message. As the political crisis in Syria deepened this week, the regime's president, Bashar al-Assad, has been refusing to make concessions to the protesters, sparking fresh bouts of unrest. In contrast, his exiled cousin, Rebel al-Assad, has been calling for peaceful democratic reform in his role as director of the Organization for Democracy and Freedom in Syria. And he joins us on the line now from London. Hello, Mr. al-Assad.
Yes, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Very good. I wanted to start, we saw earlier in the week that it seems that the president sitting in Damascus does not want to make concessions and perhaps might go the other direction. And I'm wondering, what did you make of events on Wednesday evening?
Actually, I'm extremely disappointed, as many millions of Syrians are, with the president's speech. And as you know, his advisors and his vice president had said he would announce reforms, but he did not. And it was very shocking to hear he didn't even address any of those issues yesterday.
You would know the inner workings better. How did this come about? Just the vision of one man, or was there an about face on the part of the cabinet that just said, we have to go with a more hardline approach?
It's not the cabinet itself. It's some people that are from the security apparatus that are, they have different parties from the security apparatus who are all against any reforms in Syria, because those people would lose their interest, their self-interest, if any tangible reforms, any substantial reforms happen. And they would not want to see that. As you know, he has people around from like his first cousin and from his mother's side, Rahim Mahlouf, and his other brother, Hafez Mahlouf, who's one of the generals of state security. And all those people, they know very well that they will be the first people to be brought to justice if there is any reforms in Syria.
Hello, this is Steve Bloomfield here. What sort of opposition do you think there actually is on the ground in Syria? I mean, do you think it's possible for people to organise properly against the president?
Everybody today in Syria is in opposition. Everybody in Syria today wants reforms, because everybody is suffering from the situation. When he came to power 11 years ago, he has promised that there are going to be reforms. They've been promising those people for 11 years. And those people, they can't wait anymore. Mostly today, as you've seen, they could see what's been happening all around them, in the area, in the region, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Egypt, in Tunisia. And people are, very eager to get their legitimate rights, their legitimate freedom.
Hi, it's Andrew here. Like most of the leaders in the region, he's blamed the Arab media stations for whipping up this protest and this revolt. Do you think actually that those stations actually have played a key part in what's happened over the last few days?
It's very easy. The regime, they always blame everything that happens on foreign conspiracy. They should stop blaming it on foreign conspiracies and start focusing on reforms. What people are asking for today, it's their legitimate right. It's what everybody else has been asking in the Arab world. So you cannot always continue on blaming it on foreign hand or other people, because this would be complete nonsense. And also, if you really want to have a strong country, that if there are really some foreign conspiracies, you should have a strong national unity government in Syria. That government should have all parties that believe in democracy to be part of that government. All opposition groups, all people who believe in democratic reforms. Everybody should participate in this government to have a strong national unity government.
Mr. al-Assad, if we're to believe that everyone is in fact in opposition, where would the potential strongholds be? Would we see a Libya-style situation where you would have a Benghazi versus Tripoli situation? Is that how this might unfold, that it will be, one specific center, or would it be, would it happen as a multi-centric event?
Syria is very different from countries like Egypt and Libya and Tunisia in a way that Syria is ethnically and religiously diverse. If the country does not move towards peaceful transitional reform, it could lead to chaos. You know, as you know, in Syria, we have many religions, we have many ethnic groups, we have different peoples. You know, we have Christians and Muslims and Jews, and we have Muslims, Alawites, Muslim Sunnis, Muslim Shias, Muslim Druze, and Muslim Ismailis. You know, you have the Kurds, the Turkmen, the Armenians, the Sherkas. You know, you have many different people. And all those people want to change, but they don't want violence. They don't want to see violence in their country. They don't want to see a situation where it resembles to Libya or to Iraq, which is right next door to them. So it's very important that we move towards reforms very peacefully. You know, as I said, if not, it would lead to chaos. It would be really a recipe for disaster.
These changes that you'd like to see happen in Syria, I mean, do you think they can be forced by the opposition in Syria alone, or do you think there's a need for outside help, whether diplomatically, economically, or even militarily?
No, nobody wants to see any military option. I mean, even discuss that's for sure. No way. That would lead to even a much bigger disaster. But of course, diplomatically, everybody wants to see that there should be internal pressure and at the same time external pressure to show that the international community is in supporting those protesters and that they're supporting their legitimate rights for freedom and reforms.
Hmm. I mean, when you talk of external pressure, your Organization for Democracy and Freedom in Syria, across, you know, how many regions and where are you being most vocal? And I guess, you know, where is the groundswell of support for you internationally?
I mean, we are based in London, so I've been meeting with a lot of members of parliament in the UK, in Germany, members of the European Parliament, members of the Belgian Parliament. And, you know, we've been meeting with, you know, everybody. I mean, for a year and a half now, discussing with all those years, shedding a light on really what's been happening in Syria and showing the reality of things, because a lot of people didn't know the situation in which the Syria lived. And we've been warning of a scenario like what's happening today.
Finally, before we go, based on the events or lack of movement this week on the part of President al-Assad, I mean, how slowly or quickly could things go, just obviously being close enough to the nation and what's been happening there?
There are people in the government who are trying to take advantage of the situation. For example, people in the secret apparatus who are trying to lead the country into a civil war or sectarian war because they think that could help them. You know, that would help them for keep their interest, you know, their self-interest. And also you have, on the other hand, people who are extremists or Islamists who also would like to see the country going into civil war because they think that this could also help them do their own agendas. And we have to be very careful here because, for example, the opposition, some of the opposition groups who have, for example, their page on Facebook, the Syrian Revolution or something, they started on being very transparent, very honest of what's happening, showing what's really happening inside of Syria. But today, for the last week, they have changed a bit. You know, they're becoming a bit like the regime's media. You know, they're starting, for example, to fabricate a bit thing. I saw a video, for example, on there telling that, oh, these are groups, Alawite groups who are entering Latakia. You know, they showed you some cars. Actually, those cars belong to the same video. You could see it on YouTube. These were Hezbollah fighters when they entered Beirut. So they cannot say, oh, this is the Alawites entering Latakia, which is, you know, I mean, it's not fair because this would lead to sectarian war or civil war. The opposition has to show, I mean, that they are different from the regime, that they are not fabricating things. They are honest, they are transparent, and this is how we'll be able, you know, they'll be able to get the regime to listen to the people's demands.
Rebel al-Assad, director of the Organization for Democracy and Freedom in Syria, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Steve, earlier in the week, you wrote a monocolumn which looked at what was shaping up to be quite an elaborate PR event and really soft power at its best. For those who didn't read the piece, give us the abridged version.
So the First Lady of Syria has been going on a bit of a PR drive. There was a rather fawning profile in American Vogue about a month ago. And this month, she was due to be hosting an event in Damascus celebrating Syria's cultural heritage. Now, yeah, Syria's got an amazing cultural heritage. It's well worth celebrating. But this was an event designed to boost her standing, to boost her PR, both within Syria itself and around the world. And what was interesting was the names of the people that were going there to make a speech, to make a contribution, but also to help in this sort of PR drive. And you had the director of the British Museum, you had the director of the Louvre, you had the Secretary General, sorry, the Director General of UNESCO.
I think Rob Bound was almost on the list as well, weren't you? Well, I don't think you'd take the acceptance box, did you?
But it, I mean, everyone was invited as well. You know, in terms of media, it was, you know, all the arts and culture editors from, you know, from all the major news organisations, media organisations were invited. And, you know, there's an argument that, well, maybe this is something that, you know, should be celebrated and, you know, to talked about. But equally, there's another argument that the British Museum, the Louvre and other organisations are helping to shine the image of a regime that's killing its own people.
Mm. And in that piece, it was interesting because you almost wondered that, God, they almost got to the finish line with it and they almost got away with it, and whether that would have bought the government in Damascus, you know, another 18 months. Andrew, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think there were so many things going on in the street in these kind of smaller towns around Syria and places like Dara that, you know, that made it, I think actually the kind of museum event wouldn't have worked for them. But what's interesting is that kind of balance between engagement and ability to kind of stand back and say, actually, this is not good, because that's exactly what's happened to the people who got involved with Libya. People like the director of the LSE here in London, who didn't take any money but did work for Libya, went there, tried to engage with the regime, and they ended up by losing their jobs. And it's funny that despite that, you know, you have the director, you know, someone in charge of, say, the British Museum, who's thinking, actually, I can do the same thing almost, but I won't get touched. So I think over the coming months, we'll see more of these institutions actually being a little bit more careful about who they're willing to give credence to. And as we said, how can you celebrate culture in a society where there is no freedom of expression? It's strange that you go there and you try and say, you have our culture, but, you know, we know you can't express yours.
Mm. Well, I think what's also interesting is how these countries are talked about. Yeah, so when Ian McEwan went to the literary festival in Jerusalem, he was, you know, criticised beforehand about accepting a prize there. And he made a point of making a speech about, you know, what he thought was going on in Israel and Palestine, and had a bit of criticism for his hosts. Now, you know, was Neil McGregor going to do a similar thing when he spoke in Damascus? Was he going to say, you know, you have amazing cultural heritage here, but, you know, you can't have any great modern-day culture because there's no freedom of expression? Mm. Maybe he would have.
They'd pull the mezze tray away from you right away.
Well, I think maybe.
Absolutely.
The director of the British Museum was going to see if there's anything the British Museum still didn't actually have from Syria.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. We're going to carry on this discussion with our Cairo correspondent, Jack Schenker. Back in a moment. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly, where we thought we'd keep the discussion going on the situation in the Middle East, North Africa, with our Cairo correspondent, Jack Schenker. He's here in London on a fleeting visit. Well, maybe it's not so fleeting, because I think you're going to be around for a month. But you're in London because you were lonely, because everything moved westward, didn't it?
Absolutely. You know, one day, you know, there's Molotov cocktails flying in Cairo, and the next thing you know, people are pouring into Fortnum and Mason and turning Trafalgar Square into Tahrir. So I thought I couldn't miss out.
Yeah.
I better come back sharpish.
And Steve wouldn't buy you a helmet.
Well, exactly. Yeah, unfortunately, Monocle's kind of flak jacket allowance seems to have run a bit dry.
So. It was my fault, was it? We actually do a very nice flak jacket.
Is it, has it got the Monocle after, kind of embossed? Yeah.
It's branded. It's nice.
Very, very nice. Double Kevlar.
Well, I'll have to look into that for the next violent uprising.
Yeah. One thing we've been talking about a little bit, and we had some people in from CNN earlier in the week, was just, you know, from the point of view of the networks, I think you really saw that, particularly for the U.S. networks, you know, an important story for everybody, but so many bureaus have been closed.
Absolutely.
In Cairo, and I'm sure it made you a busy man. But likewise, just from a news gathering point of view, do you think that we're going to see a situation where this just becomes the domain of Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera, and everyone is just going to say, like, well, you know, we'll worry about them for the feed. We'll have to get our one person on the ground. That there's going to be so almost this almost sort of super regional coverage, you know, in the same way that everyone had to rely on NHK in Japan because of all of the closures. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, there's definitely a risk of that. I mean, I've been in Egypt for the last 3 years, and in that time, I've been pretty much the only sort of full time British correspondent apart from the BBC who do have a bureau there. But you know, the trend, as you say, has been not just in Egypt but across the Arab world and further afield for bureaus to close, for news gathering operations to shut down, and I think that not only does that, you know, impair your ability to, you know, provide kind of instant reaction to what's going on, but it also means you miss the warning signs you know, the volatility, the underlying kind of bubbling up of dissent and instability that led to a situation like Egypt. And I found it really interesting when, you know, a lot of the analysis pieces and the broadsheets and so on said, well, nobody saw this coming. There wasn't a diplomat or a spy or a journalist who could have predicted such an incredible uprising, you know, in this kind of stagnant Western ally. In fact, everybody who's in Egypt did predict it and could see it coming because all of the warning signs were there, from, you know, a mass strike wave, which has been building since 2006, to this demographic time bomb, to the growing interconnectedness and sort of digital collaboration, which was bringing a certain sort of pan-Arab feel in terms of people exchanging information, exchanging ideas. The only question is, when would the fear barrier break? And, you know, when would that kind of bubbling up of discontent overcome the psychological fear barrier that people had in terms of confronting the security apparatus? And Tunisia really provided that spark. Mm. And so, yeah, I mean, certainly people are going to have to rethink how they manage their news gathering operations. The danger, as you say, is that people see it as one big regional story. And the next thing you know, you have a correspondent who's based in Jerusalem sent out to cover an uprising in Algeria, or, you know, somebody who's an expert in Morocco covering Yemen through the mistaken prism of this all being the same. Mm. And in fact, although there are very interconnected factors, there's also very, as your last guest pointed out, for example, Syria has this very ethnically diverse makeup, which completely changes the character of what's going on. Egypt's relatively ethnically homogenous, and you do need local experts to be able to bring out those subtleties.
Mm. Andrew, is it a good time to be a foreign editor right now? We're at the end of the first quarter, and I can imagine for a lot of news gathering organizations, you know, everything that's unfolded in North Africa, the Middle East, plus Japan, I would venture that a lot of networks, a lot of newspapers have probably blown their budget already by the end of Q1.
I think just the amount of pages that are being actually given to foreign coverage finally in our newspapers has been amazing. It's been, you know, reigniting it. Like, you know, when you're on a paper and there aren't these big stories, it's incredible how actually, the foreign news isn't very interesting to most editors of a daily paper. They're after the home news story that catches people's attentions. I want to ask you one question, Jack, which is about kind of the this has been presented as a Facebook revolution, as a kind of Twitter revolution. But I wondered how the old media in Egypt, the Egyptian old media, were now catching up with. Now they've got the shackles off them a little bit. You know, the old papers that, you know, kind of printed every story that Mubarak wanted to print it.
Sure.
How are they coping with this kind of new this new media renaissance?
Well, the shift in the media landscape in Egypt at the moment is one of the most fascinating things that's going on within the country. You did have a degree of media liberalisation happening kind of since sort of the middle part of the past decade. So there were a certain crop of independent newspapers, and obviously the satellite television market is very, very dynamic, and not just Al Jazeera but Al Arabiya and all the ones you mentioned are very active. But the state press very much dominated the media industry. And as the revolution began and the uprising began, they were placed in increasingly difficult position, whereby they were echoing the Mubarak regime's line that this was all foreign conspiracies. Just as Gaddafi has accused, you know, his revolutionaries of being pill popping Al Qaeda militants, Mubarak had his own, you know, line in sort of revolutionary humour, where he claimed that everybody was getting free meals from KFC, or at least his regime claimed that everybody was getting free meals from KFC, and there is in fact a huge KFC on the edge of Tahrir Square, which was actually shut up and boarded up, like most of the shops were. But, you know, lots of the demonstrators, using typical Egyptian wit, started putting you know, pictures of the colonel on their placard and saying, you know, "I'm doing it for him." And as the regime began falling apart internally, and within organisations and within institutions, a challenge to the power structures began to take place. And they included, you know, the huge publishing houses like Al Ahram, who are the biggest state. In fact, it's the biggest newspaper in the Middle East and is a state newspaper. You began to see tensions in the coverage. And on the day that Mubarak fell, I remember very clearly going up to a newspaper seller just hours after he'd gone and buying a copy of Al Ahram, which said in Arabic, just emblazoned across the front page, "The people have brought down the regime," kind of triumphantly, the very regime it spent so long, you know, presenting rose-tinted images of. At the moment, there's a real battle within those institutions as the staff try and get rid of the remaining links to the regime, those kind of Mubarak's former party, the NDP party. There are a lot of people still in their positions, including the managers managing editor, Oliver Al-Ahram, who are refusing to give up, and they're facing internal pressure from their staff. And so there's that battle going on, but at the same time, a lot of media experts are saying, well, is there even any relevance to this? Because as we see a liberalisation of the media landscape, that state press is going to be completely sidelined, and there's a feeling that they might have to move to a kind of BBC model of publicly funded but editorially independent media.
Rob, Twitter and or Facebook revolution, or really something which has been owned largely by the likes of Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, if you get to the core of it?
It was obviously the point, as Jack was saying, you know, that kind of like trying to turn a huge ship around in midstream, you know, these old institutions being sort of so unwieldy compared to the sort of, you know, the people power and that being able to be sort of, you know, acted upon at a moment's notice when you get something on your mobile phone. The only things we were talking to Mr. Assad on the telephone is always, again, that idea of media without context, you know, talking about unmediated pictures of soldiers, and you don't know whether they're storming Tripoli or, you know, Damascus or Lebanon, you know, and that's the problem, is the unmediated media. And although it can form a crash mob, whatever you call it, in Tahrir Square, you know, it can often be doing it for the wrong reasons.
Jack, I was going to say, Steve, with the luxury of a little bit of hindsight, but also a trip to Doha, and I don't want you to completely give away your story next month, because we did talk about the tissues most importantly, and I don't want to incentivize the readers with buckets of KFC. But how do you see it now? As much as on the day we talked about a Twitter Facebook revolution, but the view from Doha.
Well, I think, yeah, it's more of a TV revolution than a Facebook or Twitter revolution. But I think what's interesting is what happens next. One of the people I spoke about for the Al Jazeera story, you know, was talking about the weaknesses of Al Jazeera and said, look, they're very good at covering days of rage. They're not very good at covering days of constitutional committee meetings. And, you know, that can be said about pretty much every other media. And, of course, as soon as, you know, Egypt finished, everyone moved to Libya. And now everyone's moving to Syria. And I just wonder, Jack, obviously, you know, globally, the media's kind of taken its eye a bit off Egypt. Is the new media in Egypt itself keeping an eye on the days of constitutional committee meetings? And is there, you know, is there a sense that they're sort of, you know, holding people to account?
Well, I mean, it's good you ask that, because there's a real despondency amongst a lot of the activists who very much organise things in Tahrir and, you know, are the people, I think, often mistakenly described as the Facebook revolutionaries and the Twitter youth and so on. But that group of urban, educated, predominantly middle-class activists who were very much the organisational impulse on the ground, even though, of course, it turned into a much wider mass movement, they're disconsolate that the international media has very much withdrawn its attention from Egypt. And in fact, what's going on in Egypt right now is incredibly important. You know, there is very much a counter-revolution underway. There's a huge battle between people and the army. There's essentially a kind of multipolar power structure whereby different elements, including some elements of the old regime, are trying to get the ascendancy. And although it sounds very boring, debates over constitutional amendments are going to shape, you know, in the long term, the success and the longevity of this revolution. So, you know, what you are seeing is Twitter, Facebook, blogs, people are communicating on those levels. They are trying to hold the government to account on those levels. But of course, for them to be able to do that, they need to have a mass audience, and not just outside of Egypt, but within Egypt. And although internet access in Egypt has gone up exponentially in the past few years, the fact remains that if you're a farmer in Asyut, or, you know, you're a textiles worker in the Nile Delta, the chances are you're not necessarily on Facebook every day. The chances are you're not necessarily engaging with all these blogs.
And what about media startups? Is it a place where people are, newspapers are launching when you go to a press conference for, you know, for any of these constitutional matters or anything is announced, do you see, you know, different dictaphones kind of trying to jostle yours out of the way?
Definitely. I mean, that's been the case for a while. It's not just because of the revolution. I mean, certainly there are a lot of big media publishers and media pioneers who think that the time is right at the moment for new ventures. Hisham Qassem, who is a sort of legendary player within the independent media scene in Egypt and launched Al Masri El Yom a few years ago, which became one of the most important independent non-government voices voices within the media landscape, has now decided to launch another newspaper. We're waiting to see what the details are. He clearly feels that although the economy is in a lot of turmoil in the post-revolutionary world, well, I mean, the revolution is ongoing, but, you know, in the post-uprising world, there is space for a broader media landscape and that it can make money. So there are a lot of people coming forward, and also you're getting the very small, you know, the blogs and the tweeters and tweeps or whatever the correct name is for them. You are getting them there. I still think, though, that, you know, lots of people say, oh, is this going to be the death of the kind of more formal international media landscape? I mean, in fact, you do need established voices that are trusted by people to kind of mediate through all this, because there's so much misinformation, and not even just misinformation, it's just a barrage of information hitting you at all times. You do need someone to kind of mediate that.
We love you, Jack Schenker. that's a whole other program, and, as we know.
Look forward to being invited back.
You will be, don't worry. Like, that guaranteed you a seat at the top table.
I don't know, that's a slightly different question, which is the kind of...
I was going to go to a break. Anyway,
can I ask one quick question? The iconography of kind of dictatorship. You know, I wondered how quickly the images of Mubarak had been stripped away and streets renamed and institutions renamed. Has there been a cleansing process?
Well, it's kind of ebbed and flowed. On the night Mubarak resigned, people fanned out across the city to every metro station in Cairo. And one of the biggest metro stations is called Mubarak. There's a NASA station, a Sadat station, and a Mubarak station. And both at that station itself and all the other stations where you've got the maps showing the whole underground network, they scrubbed out the name Mubarak and replaced it with the Arabic word for martyrs and called it kind of Martyrs Station. So you do see that kind of thing. You do see people, obviously, you know, pictures of Mubarak have been torn down. All of that iconography has been attacked. And yet, only yesterday, in fact, when the army, the ruling generals, gave a constitutional declaration talking about how the country's going to be governed until the parliamentary elections in a few months' time, there was a big picture of Mubarak on the wall, which, you know, the journalists said about snapping immediately, and conspiracy theorists started to read a lot into. So it's an ongoing process. But, yeah, a lot of that iconography is now being collected as sort of revolutionary kitsch. And I think I've missed out on the bandwagon. I haven't collected enough enough sort of merchandise and tat to show my grandchildren.
Great. Jack Schenker, our man in Cairo via Finsbury Park, I think, isn't it? Thanks
it is.
Very much. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly from London. We're back after this. You're back with The Monocle Weekly in London, where we're about to jump over to Tokyo to talk to our correspondent, Kenji Hall. But before that, I was talking to our colleague, Noriko Okubo, who looks after all of our, I would say, I guess, our commercial and PR affairs. And it's interesting. Of course, the focus is, you know, continues to be on Fukushima. But and you think in many corners, you know, life carries on as normal. But I'm about to jump on the plane to Japan next week. And Noriko said, oh, please, before you get on the plane, can you buy batteries for me? Because, in fact, there's an enormous battery drive going on to get batteries to the north of the country. AAAs, AAAs, whatever the short, stubby ones are called as well. And it's interesting that it's, you know, of course, on one side, we've seen that the panic buying has you know, moved off of the, let's say, front page of the news agenda. But yet, almost this is becoming part of the daily narrative right now.
And also, it was interesting, I was speaking to Fiona in our bureau there. She was saying that the shoppers have become very good also on the food product side, in a slight reversal of a story, looking at where products have come from. So she said when she goes to buy milk that comes from anywhere near the area of the plant, it just gets left on the shelves. Whereas where people see milk that's been imported from Hokkaido or something, they snap it up straight away. So it's just amazing that, you know, any of those really kind of basic things that you take, batteries, milk, you know, there's a kind of all these kind of strange markets developing.
I mean, at the moment we have a number of people who are heading north right now. And I guess it's interesting, you know, we talk about sort of the demobilization that's been happening, let's say in Egypt, for example, and everyone moving west to Libya. It's something that we've been doing with our colleague Gillian, amongst others, to really do the big follow-up piece. And it's going to be interesting because, Rob, you have something coming up in the next issue. The story about NHK, which Kenji did for us, was just amazing. I don't want to spoil the story that's going to appear in print, but remarkable the might of this network.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. I mean, you know, I remember the thing that went on the page last was that box with the amazing statistics of the sort of hardware that that broadcaster has, the amount of helicopters, satellite trucks, the readiness, the strength of deployment that it has is like an army itself. I mean, it's phenomenal.
Well, that was the one thing, Andrew. We were looking at it, and the piece really focuses on, I guess you'd say sort of in a traditional newsroom, the managing editor for NHK's news service. And you're talking about not just scores of correspondents and technicians that were sent, but you know, well over 1,000 people.
Yeah, 1,200 journalists were put on the story. And also amazing that they have these incredible dry runs, you know, just in case something happens. So they do a test run just in case the Tokyo studio get knocked out and they have to go to Osaka. They had runs to what to do if there was a tsunami. So they were so efficient that they had helicopters taking off from Sendai Airport within seconds of that earthquake.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that we want to focus on. It's been interesting, the email correspondence that we had, because we touched on it in a couple of the monocolumns about, you know, when everything has, you know, reached something which comes remotely close to normal, what is the impact, not just on the supply chain, because there's been so much focus on how it impacts the likes of Nissan and Sony and Toyota, but really what's been lost in terms of really smaller businesses and, you know, craftspeople who simply aren't there anymore. Nor is the weaving machine that's been in the family for 100 years that can only make that cloth. And in touching on that, it's been interesting how many luxury goods houses all over Europe have been coming to us saying, "Oh, can you put us in touch, with these companies, because we would like to be buying things from them, you know, if you can find them. We didn't know that, yes, we know we have some suppliers there, but if some are wiped out." So it's interesting to see how even at a very corporate level, both in Paris and also in Milan as well, that these companies, I think, are sort of seeing, well, A, the opportunity to help, but also the impact as well. Kenji Hall is on the line now from Tokyo. Kenji, are you there?
Hi, Tyler.
How are you?
Good, good, thanks. How are you?
Very well. I guess you heard part of that conversation, and I wanted to pick up, just as we were saying, that there's been so much focus on what has happened, you know, with the supply chain. But, you know, earlier in the week, we had one of our favorite magazines from Japan was visiting us in London, Pen Magazine. And, for example, they were telling us that, one of the big issues for them, it was just getting an issue out. They said their paper supply was, you know, completely wiped out, and they had to, you know, go scrabble, you know, up and down the country just to find enough reels to get the next issue out. And is this something which is playing out, across a surprising number of sectors now?
Absolutely. I think you were talking earlier about milk. I mean, one of the problems with just getting milk out was the transport had been disrupted. Also, there were a couple of factories that make milk cartons. So, these industries that you wouldn't really normally think of suddenly became very important when you didn't see, you know, milk on the shelves.
I mean, what's interesting when you think of, you know, the northern part of Japan, and I guess, you know, it always sort of goes back to people reflecting what happened with Kobe. But when you look at the Tohoku region, like Hokkaido as well, just the importance, you know, on paper. And I think you talked about Hokuetsu, who are the ones who, you know, have now lost, you know, almost a month from being able to put out these cartons, and then what the impact is, not just domestically, but also, I guess, you know, international supply as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Hokuetsu has about 40% of Japan's market for, you know, drink cartons. So there's that aspect there. You're also, you know, along the entire coast of the Tohoku region, there are some major fisheries ports. Japan's third and sixth largest fishing ports are there in Ishinomaki and Kesennuma, both in Miyagi Prefecture. And a lot of these areas, they had oyster farms and seafood processing plants and boats that were just wiped out by the tsunami. So there's been a significant impact. Mm. You've also seen factories, you know, these little factories that make rubber or a resin for computer chips. You wouldn't normally think of them as important, but because they went down, you know, the companies like Samsung had problems getting supplies of chips. Companies like Toyota had problems getting batteries that go into their hybrid cars, which is why you're seeing a shortage of the Prius now. So the efficiency of the system, in fact, became a liability when some of these smaller suppliers went down.
And that has been, I guess, you know, perhaps one of the biggest issues, that you have such an evolved society. I mean, you touched on transport. I mean, just, and that's what we've seen. I mean, when logistics goes wrong in Japan, you know, a nation that you would argue sort of invented, you know, in-time delivery, then the wheels fall off everything.
Absolutely. I mean, the initially after the quake and the tsunami, one of the shortages that we saw was just petrol. Getting petrol so you could fill up a truck and ship some of your goods across the country. And so that just showed that almost no business was spared by this.
Food has certainly been one of the big issues, and you talk about the logistical challenges being able to get food to shelters and into the regions, but also just, I mean, the broader scare. I'm wondering, you know, what's happened, you know, in the last few days?
The government is so focused on resolving this problem at the Fukushima nuclear plant. 20 kilometers out is the evacuation zone. 30 kilometers out, they're telling people to stay indoors. But what we've seen is that farms that are outside of that area are being affected by radiation. And that's causing sort of a general scare among consumers who have, you know, sort of avoided vegetables from anywhere near that region.
Kenji, hi, this is Steve. Those companies that have lost their supply chains, the companies that made rubber or batteries, you know, for their products, are those major companies now looking to shift production elsewhere to areas which they believe are less prone to earthquakes? Or are they saying, no, we're going to rebuild in exactly the same place?
Right. So just to take one example, Toyota, some of its suppliers in that area had factories that were damaged either by the quake or by the tsunami. So that disrupted the production of the Prius. Just this week, Toyota said it was going to restart production, and then today it said, "Well, actually, you know, we're going to halt production for a little while." So, I mean, the disruption could go on for quite a long time.
Kenji, it's Andrew here. I was wondering, in Tokyo, where you are, I wonder, are you finding that many of the stores which are not selling kind of, you know, essential products, which maybe, you know, retailers of, you know, fashion or of things, are those things which are seen as non-essential goods, are those stores really suffering as people feel it's perhaps not the right time to be going shopping for a new outfit or going to the department stores? Have you seen, you know, around the great department stores, has there been a kind of falling off of traffic?
Absolutely. I think you touch on one really good point. One of the unknowns that this country faces is how all of this is going to affect the sort of collective consumer psyche. What you're seeing now is that there's a Japanese term, jishiku, and it means self-restraint. And you're seeing this manifest itself in all kinds of ways. Companies aren't buying ads on TV. You know, they're not going to karaoke. They're not holding weddings. They're canceling their wedding. They're not going to the department stores and shopping the way they used to. This self-restraint, it's because excessive consumerism or aggressive sort of commercial promotion is seen as inappropriate at a time when there are people, you know, whose lives are on hold or who are sort of suffering. So just incidentally, the governor of Tokyo has asked people not to hold their cherry blossom viewing parties this year because it just would not be appropriate.
Kenji, it sounds like we're losing the line a little bit. We're going to have to leave it there, but I'll look forward to seeing you next week.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you. That was our correspondent, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo. Andrew, just, you know, listening to that notion of self-restraint, which has, you know, been so much the focus of many journalists when they've been focusing their lens or sharpening up their pen on page, you know, talking just about this extraordinary national psyche. But I wonder at what point, though, as well, you arrive at a situation really at the bottom of the barrel where people do have to go out and spend now, and whether it's really part of a mental cycle that, okay, is it going to be in 2 weeks then that also we have to go out for the national good and, you know, stimulate the economy?
Yeah, and I think we shouldn't get too, you know, carried away with making this just a Japanese kind of trend. That, in fact, you notice here in Western markets, actually the stock exchange goes up when, you know, people do well, you know, a football team wins. You know, all these things, you know, markets are driven on sentiment, on how people feel, on goodwill. And if people don't feel great, it happens the same in the US, it happens the same in France, in Germany, then of course the economy kind of slows down a bit. But I think that you're right, that in the end, there has to be a point. It's like after any of these terrible disasters, you know, whether it was, you know, after, say, you know, the terrorist bombs in Bali, in the end, you have to go back. You have to start spending money because that's what employs people. That's what gets economies going. Mm. That's what, in fact, in the end, you know, will get these kind of areas rebuilt, is people actually taking money out of their wallets.
We talked about the way that something like this affects the psyche of a nation. In a strange way, what's happened in Japan is sort of similar to what's happened in the Middle East. There has been a storm and it has sort of subsided, and there has to be something that happens afterwards. And I thought originally, you know, I'm sure the birth rate in Japan will rise.
Mm.
It's always had a dwindling birth rate. This is the sort of thing people sort of pull together. People, there is a different national idea, and I feel like it's something that affects itself in, you know, in strange ways, I think.
Well, it'll all be unpacked, or at least a good part of it, because it's our cover story for the May issue, and it's a theme that really runs through from A to E, so we'll look forward to them. But we're still, I guess, 2 weeks away until we see it, Andrew?
Yeah, 10 days. 10 days.
10 days. 10 days we'll have it. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London. Back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly, where it's time for culture with Robert Bound. And Steve's around, and so is Andrew. But we won't talk to them, Rob.
I was actually wondering...
I'm off to Japan, but maybe you should join me because I think we should go and sing karaoke.
I think we should. It's been a while.
It has been a while, and someone has to keep the clubs busy in Ichime.
I don't mind doing that.
Okay.
You know me.
All right.
Okay.
Good.
Okay, cool.
See you at the airport.
I'll pack a small case just with a microphone.
Okay. NH202.
Okay. And maybe a mouth guard.
Why is that?
I don't know. Just in case you have to share it around.
Okay. which you're about to play something.
They're running out of batteries, you know.
Indeed they are.
Packs of batteries.
What you're about to play us is something that we could do as a duet.
Possibly. How harmonious are you feeling?
Well, we'll see.
This is Dengue Fever.
I've had Dengue Fever.
Is it a
you know, I had Dengue Fever.
It's fashionable. It's dangerous.
Yeah, it is quite dangerous. I was actually put into quarantine when I had Dengue Fever.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very long story. It involves the Côte d'Ivoire and...
Is it a waterborne illness affecting the nervous system?
I wasn't particularly nervous.
Okay.
I was nervous about the fact that I was parked beside a maternity ward and there were all of these ladies from Africa as well who were in a similar quarantine situation in a dreadful fever hospital in North London.
Well, that doesn't sound very good.
No, it wasn't nice.
I wouldn't want to be in quarantine. So it always sounds like when you're in quarantine, all you've got is like a bowl of water and a single Bonio. You're making your pet
passport. I also had a dry toilet as well. It's not a great story.
Anyway, let's segue into the music.
Yeah.
That's rock and roll.
Oh, here we go.
Dengue Fever are a band that have a Cambodian lead singer, hence the name, and are inspired by sort of garage punk in LA and sort of the doo-wop girl groups of Cambodia in the 1960s, which makes a sort of harmonious and rocking sound. This is the first track from their new album.
What was that?
Cannibal Courtship.
Oh, it sort of takes me back to sort of the sweaty ditches of Yamoussoukro.
In so many ways.
But in a good way. That's quite nice, isn't it? It's a really good album, actually.
It is.
And I love that sort of mixture of those sort of Cambodian harmonies and her sort of sing-songy voice and then some sort of rock behind it.
Shades of early Cardigans.
It is a bit.
Yeah.
And there's a band called Asobi Seksu, who are a half American, half Japanese band, who have that similar sort of very sweet girl vocal.
Yeah, it's great.
It's cool.
I like it. Andrew?
Yes, I like it.
It's called Cannibal Courtship, which obviously I didn't realise before I played the song. So sorry about that.
Cannibal Courtship by Dengue Fever.
Yeah. Okay. Are you buying it, Steve?
I'm not buying the name, but no, the music's great. I'm looking forward to the Brulé Bound duet version of it. But
I'll be.
Dengue.
I'll be the sweet sugary one. Do you have anything else for us this week? Any good parties? What else happened?
Well, most of the time I was sort of in the office, working at the coalface, scribbling away.
No, you were doing a land grab on my desk, because every time I come down, because I have a couple of desks in the building, and I have one at our agency, and then I have one at the magazine, and but every time I came down, it was sort of like there was a sort of a buffet sort of sprawled out over my table, in fact.
Well, there's a sense of sort of absentee landlordism here. I'm just trying to make sure nobody else really steals your desk.
Right, okay.
Yeah, you might get squatters if
you're
not
careful. I was going to say, it's sort of squatter's rights.
Yeah.
Rob did a very nice thing for me this week.
What was that?
He wrote a list of the best things about me.
Didn't he also write a list of the worst things
No. There was only one worst thing. Do you want to know what the best things about me that he could come up with?
Okay.
One...
likes loud music. Two, makes him feel important. Three, willing to share my times.co.uk subscription. Four, I know the difference between the various types of pigeon that sit outside our window.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Are there pigeons on the terrace?
Yeah, there's a wood pigeon.
Really?
I've revealed it already. I know the difference between the pigeons. But do you know what the bad thing was?
I wonder about a wood pigeon, though.
Pigeon wood, yes. Do you know what the bad thing was?
What's that?
That I thought it was a bad idea to spend money going to the zoo if you only wanted to see a pig.
It's a very specific list. We're talking about the zoo. Right. So I was thinking, and Andrew goes, "Do you like?" And I said, "Yeah, I do like the zoo. I like to go."
What the hell, Steve? What is happening when I'm not
listen,
down there?
Listen, it's fine.
I wasn't there. This is nothing right. doing me.
I was sitting in your chair.
So anyway, you said.
I think it's. I like to go to the zoo in the summer. It's quite a nice thing to do, possibly with a hangover as well. It makes you have a sort of sense of regain a sense of yourself. And I said, my favourite bit is to see the pigs, the big warthogs and things like that. And wild boars. And Andrew's like, Andrew sort of said, oh, bit of a waste of money. Just go to a zoo, see a pig.
Well, where would you go?
He has got a point. You go to a farm. If you're going to go to a zoo, there's lions, snakes, elephants.
But Rob wants an exotic pig. we're not going to get a warthog down in the Cotswolds, are you?
No.
But they've got giraffes.
You don't need to pay to see the giraffes because I see them running out of the park in the morning.
I know that's the good thing, isn't it, by London Zoo? You can get a kind of cheap version of the zoo by running
especially
around
with the giraffes.
Yeah. You can see the aviary from the towpath.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can see the kangaroos.
And actually, you can see the big pigs from the towpath, but you can't get that near them. But
can we just bring that back to me again? El canguro. I mean, that's Spanish kangaroo.
Fantastic.
And it's also the right word for a babysitter as well. Same word.
Does it also
kangaroo and babysitter.
I love it's the same word. Word. It's the same word.
I think also Seat makes a car called El Kangaroo as well. Okay. That's what we're going to send to pick you up at the airport when you get to Barajas.
I'm glad you're learning the really important words in Spanish.
This is the Monocle Week. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for our Monocle. But before we go, I want to know about this what's great, what's bad list. Who started 360 degree assessments? Or how did that list start?
the list started because Rob got a new computer. Now, Rob got a new computer, and the minute he got it, he was like, do you know the one thing bad about this computer? It's a bit smaller than my old computer. Then, half an hour later,
don't ask Andrew because he'll pull out the old Toshiba. Careful.
Literally, 30 minutes later, he said, you know this computer, the keys aren't quite as squashy as the on my old one. And then he was like, do you know this computer, I think dirt gets caught down the back here more than it did on my old one.
Well, this is only 15 minutes into it.
This is like hour two. You know the screen, I think it attracts dirt more than my old one used to.
Jesus.
it was pitiful, so I made the list of things that Rob had moaned about. So he said, right, he was going to make a list of the good and bad things about me.
Oh, the glamour.
Yeah. Let's see if our let's see if our Hugo McDonald has a moan this week as well.
In a fortnight, the annual Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair takes place in Milan. It might well be the largest, most important, perhaps only important design fair in the calendar, and this might be its 50th anniversary. But given the volume of emails, phone calls and old-fashioned post I've received, you'd be forgiven for thinking it's the only furniture fair ever to have taken place, that I'm the only person attending, and the entire future of the industry rests on my judgment. You're probably thinking, what an arrogant, spoilt brat. And though at times I can be, my frustration in this instance is justified. You see, today, if I type Salone into my email finder, it finds 1,268 emails. And by the time I finish speaking, it will be closer to 1,300. The situation gets even more complex when companies hire different press offices in each territory. And given Monocle's global reach, I find myself on the database of 5 different agencies, as well as the manufacturer's HQ and the designer themselves. It's not impossible to receive 10 emails with the same information. Emails I can cope with. They swiftly get deposited in a folder to be dealt with soon. Post can be likewise stored in a box. Phone calls, though, can't be stored, and this is how they go. Hello, is that Mr. McDonald? I'm phoning regarding an email I sent you this morning to ask if you're attending Salone. Yes, I am. Well, we have 4 events and 10 designers available for interview. Are you interested in interviewing them? Thank you, I say. I haven't started putting together my schedule, but will be in touch as soon as I have to let you know. Okay, they say, I'll phone again tomorrow. No, really, I counter, let me get in touch. It will save us both a lot of time. Phone calls like this are happening every hour. Tomorrow it will be every half hour. And as the fair approaches, they will divide and multiply like an alarming bacterial growth. But this isn't the worst part. Despite my insistence that I will be in touch, I often get follow-up emails to the tune of, "We're delighted you've agreed to interview X, Y and Z on Wednesday morning at the stand. Do let us know when suits you between 10 and 11.30 so we can firm up our schedule." Were I not struggling to stay upright under an ever-growing mountain of virtual and printed matter, I would say this is all good news for the design industry. Manufacturers clearly have more money to spend and are once again outsourcing their press and marketing to numerous agencies around the world. But this unwieldy, uncoordinated onslaught of communication is a dreadful development. I've even been blackmailed by one PR, who warned me it would be in my interest to attend a certain event, given the brand has a big advertising budget. I replied saying this is not the way Monocle works, and is not the way good PR works either. Call me precious, but whatever happened to the editor having the power to edit? And why has the global PR machine become so skewed as to be a hindrance more than a help, and even worse, a bully? The design industry is different from the fashion industry. It has never prided itself on being exclusive. What makes Salone enjoyable is precisely its open-door, access-all-areas policy. You're as likely to stumble across a story in the queue for a cocktail at 3 a.m. as you are in a string of back-to-back pre-scheduled appointments. So this year I'm going to be a spoilt brat. I'm not going to make appointments and I'm not going to make a schedule. I'm going to rely on my instincts and past experiences. I'm going to talk to people and look at things and make judgments in real time, not spend a month beforehand arranging a schedule that will fly out of the window in my first hour because I can't find a taxi. For Monocle, I'm Hugo MacDonald.
Or was it Precious MacDonald?
I love that. I didn't realise Michael Winner was our new designer.
No, I was going to say. God, be careful of those flying toys in the office.
It's true.
It's good.
It's true, isn't it, though? Yeah. Well, it's all right.
It is the most annoying phone call. I'm phoning you about the email.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm phoning about the email and anything, any email from someone that you don't know in a PR company that starts with hiya. I hate hiya emails. Hiya.
Or hey.
Yeah. No, hiya. Hiya.
Would you like a kiss at the end?
Yeah, a kiss or a double kiss. It's always great. Again, a PR I've never seen. And an XX. Very nice. Mm.
I have done that by mistake, though.
Andrew's always doing it.
I think it was to someone at the Home Office, wasn't it?
No. It was to someone at Christie's. I replied and I put a kiss at the end. And then I knew the minute I'd sent it.
That's
I'd
the
put
worst.
A kiss. So I had to write straight away. I said, "Dear sir, I've just sent you an email." And by mistake, I have put a kiss at the end. This was not meant for you. And very nicely, he wrote back and put two kisses after his name.
Is there email technology, though, which is like a time delay for, you know, a live event, that there's like a 7-second delay?
That's what you want, isn't it? You need that, as opposed to like pulling the plugs out of the way.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Warning, you're about to send a kiss.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Or like when you hit reply and you meant to hit forward.
Yeah. Or like there's a big media organization that we've been close to, that if you put a swear word in your body copy, it says, "Do you really want to send this? This is against company policy."
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. We don't have that, do we?
No, God, no, absolutely not. Are you fucking kidding? I think that's all the time we have for this week.
That was quite good, wasn't it? That's good. Light and shade in that show.
Where's your special
I haven't got one
bracelet?
Though.
Yeah.
Where can I get one that yet? In the shop?
You can get our special Support Japan bracelet in our shops, going to shops now. And you can also find them online, Rob. But they should be with us next week. I think they got on the plane earlier in the week.
If I can see through the dust on my new computer screen, I will certainly order one.
Could you please? Yes. Absolutely. And then we're going to be setting up a little table in the lunchroom for that.
Okay.
The dining room. No, anyway, our Support Japan bracelet, we've sold over 2,000 now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Exactly, which means £20,000 for Japan, which is great. Anyway, but if people want one, they can go to monocle.com or you can find them in our shops in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, London, or Los Angeles. Do you have anything else to add? Say something in Spanish. Not goodbye yet.
I was going to say, that's what I was just going to do. I've given you one or two words already. I'll do it in Spanish next week.
I can't wait for it.
Do you see, actually, see the Support Japan bracelet, actually, it's also in Spanish colours because it's red with yellow stitching.
Very nice.
It's nice, isn't it? Anyway, that's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note at weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our Monocle. And the Monocle ones are getting quite good, aren't they? We're on a bit of a roll. Traffic's up like 300%.
Yeah, we had a great Japan series, and we've had a really good kind of bout of pieces about the Middle East this last week as well.
Very good. We loved yours, Steve.
Thank you.
Not at all. Next week we'll be in Madrid, but for now, in London. I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Robert Bound.
Goodbye.